First tonight, we'll have Tom Slay. Tom was twice a poetry fellow here in 1979 and 1981, and has been an important member of the Work Center family ever since, generously offering us his time, wise counsel, and friendship as a member of the writing committee. He's the author of 10 books of poetry, including his latest Station Z, which we have copies of tonight, as well as Space Walk, which won the Kingsley Tufts Award. I could list the many other honors Tom has received over the years, but instead I'll rely on the words of someone markedly more eloquent than I am. Philip Levine wrote of Tom's work, "Slay's reviewers use words such as adept, elegant, and classical. Reading his new book, I find all those terms beside the point, even though not one of them is inaccurate. I am struck by the human dramas that are enacted in these poems, the deep encounters that often shatter the participants and occasionally restore them. What delights me most is seeing a poet of his accomplishments and his large and well-earned reputation suddenly veer into a new arena of both our daily and our mythical lives. For the writer, such daring may be its own reward. For the reader, it is thrilling to overhear a writer pushing into greatness." In addition to his poetry, Tom has written perceptive journalism about recent travels to Iraq, Somalia, Syria, Lebanon, Kenya, and Libya. In his poetry and his essays, Tom forces us to come to terms with the unsettling. Please join me in welcoming Tom back to the Work Center.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me? Hello, Alan.
Hi.
Where's April?
What's up?
There you are. Where's Laura Eve? There you are. Hi. I met with these guys several weeks ago and had the real wonderful time of getting to sit at the gourmet palace of Farland on the Work Center's nickel and got to talk to these guys about their terrific poems. So that's one of the great privileges of being part of this it's not an organization, really. I don't know what the hell it is. Anyway, it just keeps on going. And it's great to be here with my old pal, Roger Skillings. I came here as a fellow, well, you know, like Matt said, back in 1979, probably before a lot of people here were born. And
back when you were Robert Frost.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. Except, yeah, Robert Frost, but, you know. Yeah, what was I, Robert Frost? Yeah, I was. No, he's referring to the fact that I had, I was countrified back then, right, Roger? Anyway, a lot of my education was conducted at Roger's hands. I mean the good part, you know. I remember going over to Roger's apartment on Cottage Street, and Roger had a spectacular collection of classical literature over there, and he shoved on me Herodotus, which I'd never read before, and then I read Herodotus, and then he shoved on me, and ever since that time, I just finished reading a book called Why Homer Matters, and it's a really, really very beautiful book, and I would like to write a book called Why Roger Matters. So, anyway, I want to thank him hugely. He's been an old pal and a wonderful, wonderful short story writer. And Chris Busa has been here forever, and he's a wonderful... He was a tennis pro, and still is, as far as I can tell, and a terrific editor and writer. And then Matt Null... Well, you all know what Matt is, so... And the last thing I'll say in terms of this... In terms of this interminable, you know, thank you is Bob Bailey. Yes, we love Bob. Woo! Woo! And I'm deeply honored to read with Joy Williams, who's just terrific short story writer, novelist. And something that Joy wrote, I think, in an interview, she was talking about the difference between fiction and nonfiction, and she said tonally, you can do a lot more in nonfiction. And I've always thought about that in this journalism I've undertaken in the last 10 years. So, thank you. Okay, I'll read about 25 minutes. If I go over, scream. that new book is over there, which means that you can peruse it on your own. I don't need to, like, you know, do a Baedeker's guide of it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read what I'm working on as opposed to this, which I've worked on. And what that means is I'm putting together a new and selected poems. So I'm going to go back a ways, about halfway back, which is about 15 years. And then I'm just going to read forward, and hopefully I'll get to a couple of new things too, which will be in the new part of it. So, this first poem is called Newsreel. And my mother and father ran a drive-in movie theater in East Texas when I was a child. And I went to the movies every night because we didn't have babysitter, of course. And we had an old green Plymouth, and my twin brother slept in the window well here, and I slept in the window well there, and my older brother slept on the back seat. And I had to go to the bathroom one night during the movie, and I got up to go to the snack bar, and the film broke, and I got lost in the middle of the parking lot. This was during the newsreel. And the last thing I'll say about it is, of course, this was right at the height of the Cold War, and as my mother said, the creature feature always really brought them in. Everybody liked to see the aliens from outer space because they were just like the Russians. Except less scary. Newsreel. It was like being in the crosshairs of a magnifying glass, or the beams of the planets concentrating in a death ray, passing right through me, boring a hole between my shoes through the concrete floor all the way to the far side of the earth. Yet it was only not knowing how to get where I was going. I'd gotten lost in the parking lot on the way to the cinder block bunker where my mother worked the snack bar, my father the projector. The drive-in movie screen stretched horizon to horizon, the whole of Texas sprawled around, cathedral-like DeSotos and great-finned Pontiacs flickering and sinister in torrents of light flooding down the screen. Frozen in that light, I might have been the disconsolate, ageless, stone-eyed child ornamenting a pillar in a dead Roman city high up on a desert plateau. I wasn't even as tall as the speakers mumbling on and on, the way now in my dream of extreme old age I hear voices mumbling interminably. Where does it shimmer, my refuge, grotto of my swimming pool, lapping in the infinite leisure of the newsreel? At last my mother appeared from among the cars and led me back to the snack bar, but I still hovered out there, turned loose among the shadows, disembodied passions, striving for mastery above the tensed windshields. There gleams Marilyn Monroe, movie star, enjoying her fame in the voluptuous, eternal, present tense of celebrity, being worked over by hands of her masseur. Bougainvillea overgrows her beach bungalow retreat of peace and pleasure. The screen, nothing now but layer on layer of flesh the fingers knead in a delirious ballet, pushing, pulling, palms slippery and quick, ambiguous instruments of comfort or of pain. The rush of blood to her face, clouds into white light, as film stock jerks across a void half-coma blackout, half-nightmare aura. The film jammed, raw light pulsing like a bandage on a face wrapped round and round in surgical gauze. Wherever that light took me looms far from candy bars and gum wrappers blazing under glass. The movie poster death ray stopped the earth revolving. Time had stopped. My mother's black slacks and my father's not yet grown goatee, my own hands shaking nervously about were silently dissolving in that ray bombarding from beyond the galaxy, being invaded by screeching, beseeching noises of alien beings searching for a planetary home. Then, up there on the screen, frenetic in the light, was a hair, trembling between two cloven lobes of shadow that were part of the projector's overheating brain, its brilliantly babbling, delusional, possessed by shadows, dispossessed brain. And I'll jump ahead to this next book. I like dogs. They're very strange creatures. And my mother had a wonderful dog who would look into your eyes and then the light would hit it in that thing called the tepetum lucidum. And you would suddenly realize, God, I had no idea what's going on in that dog's mind. Definitely not man's best friend. And also must have extrasensory perception. And in this poem, it's called Space Station, I envision my mother's kitchen as a kind of space station, and space stations as I, back in the 1960s, when I knew about this stuff, they generate gravity by revolving, and then when they reverse, there's a moment of weightlessness. And this poem takes place in the moment of weightlessness. My mother and I and the dog were floating, weightless, in the kitchen. Silverware hovered above the table. Napkins drifted just below the ceiling. The dead, who had been crushed by gravity, were free to move about the room, to take their place at supper, lift a fork, knife, spoon. A spoon, knife, fork that, outside this moment's weightlessness, would have been immovable as mountains. My mother and I and the dog were orbiting in the void that follows after happiness of an intimate gesture. Her hand stroking the dog's head and the dog looking up, expectant, into her eyes. The beast gaze, so direct and alienly concerned, to have its stare returned. The human gaze that forgets for a moment that it sees what it's seeing and simply, fervently sees. But only for a moment. Only for a moment were my mother and the dog looking at each other, not mother or dog, but that look. I couldn't help but think, if only I were a dog, or mother was, then that intimate gesture, this happiness passing, could last forever. Such a hopeful, hopeless wish I was wishing. I knew it and didn't know it, just as my mother knew she was my mother and didn't. And as for the dog, her large black pupils, fixed on my mother's faintly smiling face, seemed to contain a drop of the void we were all suspended in. Though only a dog who chews a ragged rawhide chew toy shaped into a bone, femur or cannon bone, of the heavy body that we no longer labored to lift against the miles-deep air pressing us to our chairs. The dog pricked her ears, sensing a dead one approaching. Crossing the kitchen, my father was moving with the clumsy gestures of a man in a spacesuit. The strangeness of death moving among the living. Though the world was floating with a lightness that made us feel we were phantoms. I don't know if my mother saw him. He didn't look at her when he too put his hand on the dog's head, and the dog turned its eyes from her stare to his. And then the moment on its axis reversed, the kitchen spun us the other way round and pressed heavy hands down on our shoulders so that my father sank into the carpet, my mother rested her chin on her hand and let her other hand slide off the dog's head, her knuckles bent in a kind of torment of moonscape erosion, ridging up into peaks, giving way to seamed plains with names like the Sea of Tranquility. Though nothing but a metaphor for how I saw her hand, her empty, still strong hand, dangling all alone in the infinite space between the carpet and the neon-lit ceiling. We had a dog, let's have a cat. This sort of marks the epoch of when I began doing this journalism about 9 years ago. I'm not going to say a lot about this stuff. If you're interested, you know, it's out there. I'm not a real journalist. I do long-form essays. I have to go back repeatedly to places. I don't have any views. My views are boring. My politics are knee-jerk liberal, also boring. And I'm not interested in that kind of thing at all. So I'm interested in texture, and I'm interested in political emotions as opposed to political convictions, and emotions are very unruly and difficult to come to terms with. Anyway, I was in Lebanon doing a piece on Palestinian refugees just after the 2006 war, and the country had sort of erupted into a mini civil war. I'd never been in a situation like that before. You know, I am not the war as hell war correspondent. You know, I definitely do not want to be in the helicopter with what's-his-face lying about his... You know, I actually kind of detest that sort of macho posturing. I hate it, actually. Anyway, poem's called Army Cats. And I had to go to the south of Lebanon. This is where most of the fighting took place. And I had to go to this command post, the CP, in order to get the permission to go down past the checkpoints, which were basically, you know, stacks of old tires set up. And this is sort of, you know, what happened. I was in the middle of this. There was a whole bunch of tanks in front of me, small tanks, not big tanks, not like the Tiger tanks we have, like little tanks. And there were these shadows moving all through this really, really hot day, and I couldn't figure out what it was, and I suddenly realized, oh, those are cats. And they were like on the tanks and under the tanks, and just everywhere. And there was a cemetery, a Christian cemetery, and then the sea beyond the command post. And that's all, enough of my blah, 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 blah. Three parts. Over by the cemetery, next to the CP, you could see them in wild catmint, going crazy. I watched them roll and wriggle, paw it, lick it, chew it, leap about. Pink tongues stuck out, drooling. Cats in the tank squat shadows, lounging. Or sleeping curled up under gun turrets. Hundreds of them sniffing or licking, long hind legs stuck into the air. Great six-toed brutes fixing you with a feral, slit-eyed stare. Everywhere, ears twitching, twitching, as the armor plate, expanding in the heat, gave off piercing little pings. Cat invasion of the mind. Cat tribes running wild. And one big pregnant female comes racing through weeds to pounce between the paws of a marble dog crouching on a grave, and sharpens her claws against his beard of moss before she goes all silky, luxuriously squirming right under the dog's jaws and rolls over to expose her swollen belly. Picture her with gold hoop earrings and punked out nose ring, like the cat goddess Bast, bronze kittens at her feet, the crowd drinking wildly, women lifting up their skirts as she floats down the Nile, a sistrum jangling in her paw. Then come back out of it and sniff her ointments, Lady of Flame, Eye of Raw. 2. Through the yard, the tanks come gunning, charioteers laughing, goggles smeared with dust and sun, scattering the toms slinking along the blast wall, holding back the waves from washing away white crosses on the graves. The motors roaring through the afternoon like a cat fuck, yowling on and on. The gun turrets revolving and the cat's eyes swivel and shine, steel treads clanking, sending the cats flying in an exodus through brown, brittle grass, the stalks barely rippling as they pass. 3. After the last car bomb killed 3 soldiers, the Army website labeled them martyrs. 4 civilians killed at checkpoints, 3 on the airport road, a young woman blown up by a grenade. Facts and more facts, until the dead ones climb up out of the graves, gashes on faces, or faces blown away like sandblasted stone, that in the boarded up museum's fractured English leaves the onlooker riddled and shaken, nothing but a pathetic gaping. And then I remember the ancient archers, frozen between reverence and necessity, who stare down the enemy, barbarians as it's told, who nailed sacred cats to their shields, knowing their foes, outraged in their piety, would throw down their bows and wail like kittens. Different kind of war. It's called self-portrait with shoulder pads. I mean the football kind. My twin brother and I were football players in high school. I'm still recovering. And anyway, the poem makes mention of Joe Pyne. Anybody here remember Joe Pyne? Joe Pyne was the uber talk show host who would have people on his show and he would insult them. He also had a wooden leg, and he had Frank Zappa on once, and they had a kind of extraordinary, probably apocryphal exchange, but I don't care. It's true in my poem. Anyway, Tim and I once, the coach said, Tommy, come out here. Timmy, come out here. You guys get down here, and I blew the whistle. You guys smash into each other. And then you keep doing that until I blow the whistle again. We said, okay. This is where this poem takes off from. And then at the end of it, the moral was, you see, these guys are brothers, and see how hard they like to hit. There you go. Brother fighting brother, and the loser driven out. My eyes were on Tim's eyes, off someplace, gone from his body. While under his jersey, the shoulder pads gleam brighter. Masculine yoke we both labor under, determined not to get knocked flat. Smashing and smashing into each other, helmets blankly ringing, to the whole team screaming in time to the drill, Timmy, hit Tommy, Tommy, hit Timmy, until, exhausted, we fall to our knees, and still coach refuses to blow the whistle, so that we, on our knees, keep ramming into each other, implacable, servile, our hearts too violent not to play inside the rules. How we envied the hippies on the Joe Pine show, Pine sneering to Frank Zappa, "So, I guess your long hair makes you a woman." Zappa shooting back, "I guess your wooden leg makes you a table." White as calcium, white as moons brought down into swamp water, white as a cataract on a blind eye, the pads fuse onto shoulder bones to make us walk that athletic walk of power and glory and terror of shame. So Tommy hitting Timmy and Timmy hitting Tommy takes over mind and body in the zone until coach blows the whistle and we get up off our knees and turn to avoid each other's faces. Years later, brought down by gunflash insights of assassination and business frowns of gangbangers dividing up junk, while police held the line in riot masks and shields, I prayed for the cup to pass. But either way, I was an ass and had to carry my ass's load as far as an ass could. And now we're up to this book. You know, I just realized I have a poem about being an ass. It's right here. And that wasn't planned or scripted. From the ass's mouth, a theory of the leisure class. I played bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream. Remember how he gets transformed into an ass and he sees, you know, the queen of the fairies and has this great experience. Anyway, one thing I'd forgotten about the play was that, you know, all the aristocrats, the, you know, Theseus, and of course they all speak in verse, blank verse, and the mechanicals, as they're called, they speak in prose. But the during the play that the mechanicals put on for the aristocrats during the marriage of Theseus, the aristocrats sit there and make like kind of nasty comments about, you know, how quaint the mechanicals are. I didn't just totally miss that until I reread it lately. Up on stage in the three quarters empty auditorium, the lights turned down, up where the auditorium resounded to a Midsummer Night's Dream performed clumsily by me, reading out Bottom's speech when he turns from an ass back into a human, while the rest of the class sniggered or flirted, sat back and chewed gum. The words in the auditorium lived out their hour. And after rehearsal, when I got on my bike, red bike, fat tires, to pedal home under cottonwood trees, I turned round corners I'd never seen in our tiny mountain town. Years and years went by. I was still pedaling. It wasn't a dream, except maybe in the way logic works in dreams. I had two heads now, my ass's head, my human head. My ass's bray more eloquent than my human bray of wonder at my change. The eye of man hath not heard, the ear of man hath not seen, my stumbling tongue piecing through Shakespeare's bitter oratory about no bottom to Bottom's dream. I put my bike in the carport and started throwing a tennis ball against the brick wall, thinking over and over, no bottom, no bottom. The harder I threw, the more the words weren't mine. The ball smashing brick while there in the auditorium, the words were like a taunt, like Theseus's taunt spoken behind my back, because I was just an ass, not Duke of Athens. But after the play, the cast gave me the papier-mâché ass's head, and I kept it first in the room I shared with my two brothers, putting it on to sniff the dried glue, feel the claustrophobic fit, and stumble half blind to the bathroom mirror, where I looked out at myself through holes in the muzzle, the asses painted on eyes and lips, what people saw when they saw me. Shakespeare's words booming back from the head's suffocating hollows, coming straight from the ass's mouth, not mine. I don't remember how, but it ended in an alcove above the carport where it softened on the chicken wire. The paper sagged and began to flake away, the muzzle and the eye holes shriveling into a gray, ulcerous mass. When we moved from the town, it got thrown into the trash, taken to the dump and burned. Onion eaters, garlic eaters, hard-handed men. That's what Bottom and the Mechanicals were. And that's what I was, what I've always been, riding along on my bike's fat tires while that half-god, half-man Theseus laughs his courteous contempt of us whose words come out like a tangled chain. Which is why there's no bottom, why there's never been a bottom, if you're just an ass who speaks prose to the Duke's verse. An ass who kissed the Queen of the Shadows and never got over it. My long, scratchy ears and hairy muzzle pressed to the ethereal, immortal, almost not there-ness of her skin. And then I'll finish with a poem called Homage to Bashaud. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's 23 pages long. Gasp. I'll just read a couple sections from it, just excerpts. And Bashaud's the 17th century Japanese poet who wrote, you know, travelogues of his travels through Japan, a narrow road to the far north or deep north is one of them. And basically what happens is he has a little prose description of something and then a poem that kind of encapsulates how he feels about it. And so I thought, well, that'd be an interesting form. So this poem is called Homage to Bashaud. It has to do with this trip I took to Iraq last December. I was there for about 2.5-3 weeks and traveled all over the country. I was taken there by a guy named Chris Merrill, the International Writing Program. And Chris takes people abroad to go to places like, well, the only person crazy enough to go to Iraq is me. But anyway. It was an amazing place, incredible. So we were there at the invitation of university professors, and we traveled to lots of different universities, and we met lots of Iraqi writers, and we met hundreds of Iraqi students. And English is a majorly popular major over there. I mean, there are 3,000 English majors alone at the University of Basra. So one of the things they seemed to be interested in was doing creative writing workshops, which they've never done before. And so we did some. And they wrote in English or they wrote in Arabic, depending on what they were comfortable with. And it was amazing. Because it was an entire generation that had grown up during war. And we did this little exercise, and it was, you know, I remember. And at a certain point, I would say, no, I want you to write about what you don't want to remember. And what came out was, it was just right there underneath the surface. And they told us things we would never have heard any other way. So I'm just going to start and just read a little bit of this. What I have to say about my trip meanders the way the Tigris and Euphrates meander. And like those rivers in flood, is sometimes murky in intention, balked in its conclusions, and flows where it has to flow. In Iraq, in which the customs and conventions were often operating invisibly or easily misinterpreted to be the same as mine, I suppose I gave up on telling a straightforward story. Instead, one night in a helicopter, what I felt in the air, so different from what was happening on the ground, made me realize that when you take an oath to tell the truth, you're not telling that truth, either to the judge or to the courtroom. Perhaps the point of the oath is to try to surround yourself with the lightness and solitude from which you can speak the truth, adding whatever light and shade you can so as to make the how implicate the why. After all, the judge and the members of the court weren't riding in the helicopter, so a realistic description won't mean anything to anyone unless you add that light and shade which only you, as the witness, could perceive. But even then, in the helicopter roar, the truth may be hard to hear, even in your own ears. I prove myself to be inept at putting on my bulletproof vest, attaching this to that in all the wrong places, before figuring out how to Velcro the waist panels tightly around my stomach so that they were under the vest, not over it, and adjusting and readjusting the shoulder straps to make sure they were tight. I didn't look very military. In fact, I looked like I was wearing a bib, a sort of Rambo Jr. Now that I was strapped into my vest, it felt fairly lightweight, around 8 pounds, thick enough, according to the specs, to give reasonable protection against handguns. But when you consider that a bullet fired from a military-style weapon is the equivalent of a 5-pound sledgehammer smashing into you at 45 miles per hour, serious bruising and broken ribs are pretty much guaranteed. I put on my helmet and snapped the chin snap fast, but I had to keep pushing it back from sliding down over my eyes. Rather than protected, I looked and felt like an overgrown infant. In front of our armored vehicle, a Chevy Suburban SUV reinforced with steel plating, a beefy but terminally polite security contractor sporting a buzz cut gave us a briefing. Once you're inside the vehicle, please stay away from the doors. We'll let you in and out. If we take fire, or if I give you the signal to get down, I'd appreciate it if you could get on the bottom of the vehicle. I'll climb in back with you and cover you. Once we get to our destination, you can leave your armor and helmets in the vehicle, then we'll open the doors and we'll proceed single file to our destination. Everything clear? In one of our workshops, a slight young woman wearing a black and white headscarf, with a round face and large black eyes, and with just a hint of mascara on the lashes, stood up to read her poem. Her name, I think, was Miriam, and she stood very straight in front of her classmates and read to us with a quiet, unselfconscious dignity. Her pronunciation was excellent, so I have a good memory of what she wrote. She said that she was woken near dawn by her older brother in her bedroom, who had bent down to gently kiss her on the cheek and to ask her if she wanted anything special in the market. And when she looked up at him to tell him no, he said to her very gently that this would be the last time she'd be seeing him. But she was so sleepy, she didn't quite take in what he meant. And a moment later, he was gone. Later that morning, she wrote, she was in the kitchen having breakfast with her mother. And then their neighbor came in and gave them the news. She wrote that as she heard the news, she felt herself get smaller and disappear. She had no hands, no face, no body to feel with. There was no kitchen, no mother, no her. The neighbor, she wrote, told them about the car accident. She wrote how she remembers her brother's words coming back to her, how gentle he was when he kissed her on the cheek, how he would always bring her special things from the market. And then she sat down, seeming completely self-possessed, except for the sadness that had come into her voice and hung now in the room. No one said anything for a while, as what she hadn't said didn't need to say, since everyone in her generation already understood, resonated for a few moments. Chris and I looked at each other, but were slower in grasping what it was she'd left out. And then it dawned on us too. Her brother had been a suicide bomber and blown himself up in the car. The chopper's sides were open to the night air, and I instinctively shoved myself back on the bench as far as I could get. Not very far, it turned out. Certainly not far enough to quell my unease about hurtling through the air with no door in front of me. The contractor gave me thumbs up, and I at least knew enough to give thumbs up back, and then the chopper blades accelerated faster and louder. He slid the lenses of his night vision goggles past the lip of his helmet and down over his eyes to keep watch for snipers on the ground, and then we slowly ascended, the nose of the chopper dipping slightly as the tail lifted up, and we soared straight until the pilot adjusted the pitch of the rotors, and we shot ahead, eventually climbing to about 100 feet over the city. Everything was dark down below for the first quarter mile, and then we were crossing over Baghdad, the lights of the cars on the road flickering softly, house lights shining in the windows. The pilot occasionally flicked a switch on the instrument panel, and then, as we rose higher and the night air got very cold, the contractor slid the Lexan glass doors closed on the passenger part of the tiny cabin. The chopper shimmied back and forth in the light wind, soft buffets, almost the way a child might pet a cat on the head. Just above the pilot's helmet, silhouetted against the curved glass of the windshield, shimmered another little galaxy. Switches glowing in the darkness, an overhead instrument panel lit up the pilot's hand as he leisurely lifted his left arm from time to time to switch something off or on. For a moment, I felt immensely happy. I had the reverie of myself as a child looking up at day glow stars stuck to the ceiling over my bed. A memory I knew to be false, since I'm way too old for such things to have existed when I was a kid, nor are my parents the type to indulge me with day glow stars. I knew, even as I took pleasure in it, that my fantasy was out of sync with the reality on the ground, not to mention the contractor hunching forward, his gun in his lap, intently scanning the darkness below. At least the contractor had his orders and his night vision goggles. What I had to go on was a drone of helicopter noise, its surgical detachment from the neighborhood alleys and streets, and the way my own hypervigilant senses magnified and crystallized the light and dark flow of the city beneath me. One of Saddam's former palaces, encircled by a moat that testified to the dead dictator's love of water, glowed dimly below us, looking like an Arabian Nights fantasy in bad taste, and reputed to have a torture chamber in the basement. Aloft in the chopper and looking down, I found and continue to find it hard to know what tone to take when the truth is both atrocious and banal. UH-1N. The light lift Huey rose from the floor of night into the darkness of the brain, where it felt the sullen winds pushing it this way and that, following the current of a thought into a blankness and far-seeingness that, as I rose in the actual chopper, released me to confront the scabbard of Orion's belt. Behind him, the scorpion menaced his exposed heel. But then the rotor roar filled up the space between night sky and ground dark. The imagination slipped down over my eyes like a pair of night vision goggles. What they showed me was myself strapped in, staring down at Baghdad, at one of Saddam's kitsch palaces that looked like something out of the 1001 Nights in which Scheherazade's unending flight of words to keep the Sultan from murdering her can preserve her from his scimitar. How picturesque the imagination envisions the storied world lit up by infrared. How the helicopters retracted doors, letting in the cold night air, refreshed and restored the Sultan in me, while putting under threat of death the insurgent imagination that thinks it can talk its way out of the void it hovers in, its blades rendered an invisible blur as it holds its position in the darkness, intent on the levitating heaviness that allows it to convince itself, suspended in the air, that it's really weightless. This is the last one. Before rain. Whatever you do, there are rockets falling. And after the rockets, smoke climbing up through walls that are exploding. Trees grow up where there once were people. Weeds take over beds of lettuces and coddled flowers. Uprearing molehills unpopulate the fields. The bricked-in hours of the human have all been knocked down. No one lingers at lipstick counters. No one stares into a screen to escape the digital mayhem of heroes hurtling over the heads of monsters. The old bones on the mountain that stand upright and shake when winds blow up from the shore. Old bones that shake when the winds roar. Now dangle in the void of an unknown dimension. Forget all this, says Earth to the stars. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. It's a great pleasure to welcome Joy Williams back to the Work Center. She visited last year and seemed to like the place, so we invited her back as our distinguished writer-in-residence, reprising a tradition that has brought esteemed writers like Galway Kinnell and Tomas Tranströmer to the Work Center for an extended visit to meet the fellows, read manuscripts, and be a part of the local arts community. Joy has been doing all of that this week, as well as bravely facing down a temperamental hot water heater. She's the author of 4 story collections and 4 novels, including The Quick and the Dead, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Her work is as startling and original as Flannery O'Connor's. Joy has written that good writing never soothes or comforts. It is no prescription, neither is it diversionary, although it can and should enchant while it explodes in the reader's face. Michael Silverblatt says of her work, "To wait 10 years for a Joy Williams book is worth the wait, but I'd like one every week, though I probably wouldn't survive it, the onslaught. The degree of holiness and terror, the beauty, the poetry, the strangeness of her work consistently dazzles me." Please join me in welcoming Joy Williams.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I do like Provincetown, particularly in February. I really like it. I also just want to mention 2 fantastic names tonight. 2 wonderful writers, Robert Stone, who died recently and who is memorial service is being held in Key West as we are gathered here. And Phil Levine, who is very ill in California. And these are just 2 amazing voices, and we must reread them because they're very important, and we've lost them. This is just a short piece. It's called George and Susan. Gurdjieff has made a pilgrimage to the desert, to Tucson, Arizona, where Susan Sontag spent her formative years. G is in love with Susan Sontag, dead now sadly, but all the more reason. He's crazy about her. She hated the desert, but no matter. The desert had her in her formative years. The desert is irreducible and strange, and it is not Mary. It is never Mary. Not even the baby roadrunners and javelinas know how to play. It is work, 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 hopeless living work. G pictures her as a little girl. He carries a snapshot of her in his mind, a little girl ferociously unhappy and intense, kicking rocks in the desert. She fought the desert with her every cell. It was difficult work. To live against oneself, that is the ideal, because the self does not exist. She refused the lovely warm tortillas the housekeeper made. She did not play with the horny toad. She did not collect bones and bottles, teeth and pretty stones. She didn't even want a birthday party because her birthday would be in the desert, the detested desert, which loved her as only the desert can, with blazing, burning disinterest. The desert instilled in her a desire to live at any cost. In the desert, G misses his cows. Rather, that part of himself that would miss his cows in their absence misses his cows. He can picture Susan Sontag's splendid eyes flash with scorn were he to tell her the names of his cows, were he even to mention his like of cows. Susan Sontag believes, as does he, that it is imperative not to make unnecessary talk or spend time discussing ordinary life. G's cows' names are Equivocal Tuata, Bridget, Natasha, and Balduafirm. Bridget's name was a bit of horseplay. Who couldn't remember the name Bridget? G is lying on a bed in the motel Father Kino in his underwear, a clay flower pot filled with stones and water in the open doorway. He refuses to use air conditioning. Air conditioning is a crime. Really, it should be a felony. Normally, he doesn't think like this. Impartiality is his compass rose and G the unflappable helmsman, but he's associating here. Maybe it's the heat. 111. Of course, Phoenix is even higher. 116. It is one of the graces bestowed on Tucson. It is never, ever hotter than Phoenix. G hates air conditioning, and he loves Susan Sontag. There you have it, whoever you are. G's modest fart is murmurous and comforting. When someone died, his grandmother would always say, "Well, he'll fart no more." G sleeps and does not dream. When he awakens, he dreams of Susan Sontag, how he wishes to hold her pale hand, to speak of anamnesis. They would have tea or even a cocktail. They would speak of death and life, of how one needs to fight, not with hope. Hope is a weak value, but in defiance and fascination. How he longs to stroke her skunk-striped hair. What was this mad wish of hers to be buried in France? G hates France and her morbid cemeteries. The French only pretend to understand. They do not understand. Susan should be buried here in the desert. She is more here than there, certainly. G feels sad. He observes himself feeling sad. He's got to get up and about again, out of this motel, Father Kino, where he seems to be the only guest. There is the black snake in the armoire, but G suspects he lives here and is not a guest at all. G pets snakes whenever the opportunity arises. He's been told that snakes often have salmonella on their skin, and he shouldn't pet them. No one should pet them as a simple health precaution. But he does. In his experience, he enjoys it, and the snake enjoys it. What would Susan make of the black snake in the armoire of the motel, Father Kino? She would write an essay about it. The motel would vanish, the armoire would vanish, and lastly, the little black snake. The essay would be brilliant and troubling, alluring. Every sentence could be read as both a beginning and an ending. The mind would be shaken awake. Oh, Susan is one in a million, one in 12 million. a number that she arrives at not without reason, for the mighty saguaro, the desert's emperor, may produce millions of seeds in its centuries of life, yet only one might survive to grow. Out of 12 million, one. You are that special, Susan, that improbable. She would find distasteful the maize and mites, but she could not argue with the sentiment. Susan's number is 5, the number of magic, the pentacle. Even Susan Rosenblatt, the name she disowned, was a 5. G himself is a 2, better than ho-hum, certainly, but it is only through effort, through will, through work, 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 that 2 becomes extraordinary. G lumbers into the bathroom to perform his ablutions. He regards himself in the medicine cabinet mirror without emotion. He opens the cabinet. The shelves hold only circles and the glass circle overlapping circles where bottles and tins once rested, Band-Aids, aspirin. But someone has written inside the door in a terribly sloppy hand, for usually these things are written in a graciously cursive style. When Anna Pavlova was dying, she said to her attendant, "Prepare my swan costume." It is written in Russian, thank goodness. His English is not that good. He tried his hand in an English as a second language course once, but all his fellow students wanted to learn to say was, "What is your name and telephone number? And have you eaten lunch yet?" Wedged and glinting in a shelf bracket is a single razor blade. Of course, nothing rusts out here. It looks brand new, ageless. This is why all the old motels are being demolished. Desperation has infused their every fixture. He closes the cabinet, turns on the water taps, and scrubs and smacks his face vigorously. He dries himself with a thin, bleach-reeking towel, combs his mustache, and collapses once more on the bed. Folded neatly on a chair are his gray suit, white shirt, and dandelion yellow tie. On top of this pile, his truck tire sandals. This was what he had worn when he had gone to 2409 East Drachman, Susan's childhood bungalow, sacred ground. Though, of course, home is not a place but a power. He wished he'd said that. Who did say that? He suspects it was that Christian Science seeress. She was all right. Can't do much better than home is not a place but a power. G had knocked politely on the door of 2409 East Drachman and asked to see the hole Susan had dug in the backyard. He was asked to leave. She used it to sit in and think, he explained. It was 6 feet deep and 6 feet wide. He was informed that the police would be called were he not to leave. He supposes he could not expect unconscious man personified in this instance by a pimpled business student just renting to preserve the hole Susan Sontag dug 1-7. G smiles his wolfish smile, resisting negative emotion with ease and retreats. He retreats to a hotel bar where he orders a glass of Armagnac. He drinks it and orders another. As his grandmother would say, a birdie can't fly on one wing. The Armagnac tastes marvelous. He can't imagine it tasting any better were he alive. Where was he? The desert and Susan Sontag. Two great forces working in exquisite opposition to the other's essence. She wanted to be seen as a writer, as mind, a large, voracious mind that would not die. How she hated the desert, her childhood, a prison sentence, a waste of time. She hated the desert's silence, its incomprehensibility, its brute simplicity, its power. She would not succumb to its mystique, to its meaning, which is death, anonymity. It was difficult work, conscious work, to dig a hole wherein she would begin composing a self that would forget nothing, that would defer to nothing. A hole 6 feet wide and 6 feet deep, her own troupe de loop, holiest of secular holes, of intellectual holes, the hole Susan dug unaided with her own childish hands behind the bungalow at 2409 East Drachman in Tucson, Arizona. How G got back to the motel, Father Kino, he can't remember. Since he's been dead, this kind of thing happens more often than he would like, these slippages. One would think that with all the work he poured into the work when alive, these lapses wouldn't occur, but naturally, one could only imagine, when one is dead. Forgetfulness of existence becomes more and more the norm. To work when one is dead is like painting legs on a snake, as his grandmother would say, the annoying woman. G sighs, but it's like he's holding his breath. He wiggles his toes, he shakes his fingers. When he was small, he was always getting slivers, then no more. How he'd like a good sliver now, in hand or foot, to work out carefully, to coax out entire from its delicate tunnel beneath the skin. G is shocked at how his mind is sleepily toying with him. Susan, he thinks sternly. Susan, I pledge. Fealty is a word that keeps bumping around him like a fly. Fealty. He has always been attracted to the follies of writers. Their pursuit is so unnatural. It is so willed. There was that one who came to him, the tubercular, the one they made all the fuss about, that Catherine person, but she lacked the moxie. Susan would have snapped her like a carrot. Susan. She swims into focus before him, pure icon. She had to dare herself to action day after day to overcome her crushing fits of melancholy. Work, work, dig, dig. When she spoke about her writing, it was always in terms of agonizing labor. She had over 15,000 books in her library, or it might have been over 18,000 books. G wonders shyly if his own were among them. He doubts it, but perhaps. She would have discovered him eventually in her quest and his inarticulatable repository of the ancient and ineffable. Better to have been introduced through dance, the revelation of the dance. G rises and creakily engages in a few movements, at times colliding with the armoire. This room is cramped as the grave. Through the narrow window beyond the faded, sun-ripped buckaroo curtains rises the moon. He pictures Susan with him in black, hungry, intent, awkward, proud. Exhausted, he staggers into the bathroom again, where he pours water over his massive head. Within the cabinet, everything is as it was. Prepare my swan costume. If you were inclined to say last words, they were pretty darn good ones. Pavlova was a great dancer, a great Russian. Not all Russians are great. They abuse their gifts. That idiot Balanchine, for instance, he put 50 elephants in pink tutus and choreographed them in a ballet with music by Stravinsky. The crowd roared with amusement. God's most divine and improbable and tender creation, the most beloved of all his children, was presented as a joke. Sad. G feels sad. Men are but unconscious machines, and they perform their cruelties so effortlessly. He has never felt so sad. He must have made conscious effort in the past not to think of elephants, but now their eternal plight, the horror of it, engulfs him. He hardly knows where he is. His thoughts have so thoroughly entrapped him in their sticky web. Blindly, he pulls on his clothes, gray suit, white shirt, dandelion, yellow tie. On his feet, truck tire sandals appear. He opens the door. He is in the desert. In the desert, seeking to affirm his other, his cherished one, his opposite, Susan Sontag, who probably wouldn't even stand him to a brandy, which he would very much like. In that lovely hotel bar, in the unlikely event he could even find the place again. Nonetheless, he sets forth. The traffic is terrible. Machines, driven by machines, screaming and streaming past. Some jeer and lurch playfully at him. He resembles a stranger, an outsider who does not love them. He is a stranger, an outsider who does not love them. Once again, he stands before the humbleness that is 2409 East Drachman and knocks on the door. There is no reply, but the night, roaring witlessly about him, is far from still. He nudges the door with his finger and it flies open. Cans of SpaghettiOs and Pat's blue ribbon litter the table. There is a small stuffed owl in a birdcage and expensive bicycles hang suspended from the ceiling. The room is cold as a meat locker, the front door perfectly aligned with the back one. He was right to come to this inauspicious place. He feels unbalanced, desperate in his joy, in his confidence. Here, Susan struggled against death, against anonymity, when she was just a child, when she wasn't even old enough to keep track of her socks. Here she worked, 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 creating herself as though from wax, a candle. She hardly has the strength now to open the other door, the one that leads into the yard. She loves Susan Sontag. He has always loved her. Experience is not always based on what is theoretically possible. One of his cardinal beliefs, and one that works well in this situation. He steps forward, and his sturdy sandals sink into what has to be half a foot of pea gravel that covers every inch of earth within the small surround. Only the moon observes G's efforts as he struggles to address the non-existent hole. The sound of traffic on the wide, congested avenue fills his great ears. It is quite as though he were drowning, he who never learned to swim. Then there is a god-awful crash and silence, as though nothing has happened. Thanks.